though there were a lot of people there, and we were discussing the problems of the bomb. I was back in a corner somewhere. He came and went, and all I could see of him was from between people's heads. In the morning of the day he's due to come next time, I get a telephone call. Hello? Feynman? Yes? This is Jim Baker. It's his son. My father and I would like to speak to you. Me? I'm Feynman. I'm just a... That's right. Is 8 o'clock okay? So at 8 o'clock in the morning, before anybody's awake, I go down to the place. We go into an office in the technical area, and he says, We have been thinking how we could make the bomb more efficient, and we think of the following idea. I say, No, it's not going to work. It's not efficient. Blah, blah, blah. So he says, How about so-and-so? I said, That sounds a little bit better, but it's got this damn fool idea in it. This went on for about 2 hours, going back and forth over lots of ideas, back and forth arguing. The great Niels kept lighting his pipe. It always went out. And he talked in a way that was ununderstandable. Mumble, mumble. Hard to understand. His son I could understand better.
Well, he said finally, lighting his pipe, I guess we can call in the big shots now.
So then they called all the other guys and had a discussion with them. Then the son told me what happened. The last time he was there, Bohr said to his son,
Remember the name of that little fellow in the back over there? He's the only guy who's not afraid of me, and will say when I've got a crazy idea. So, the next time, when we want to discuss ideas, we're not going to be able to do it with these guys who say everything is yes, yes, Dr. Bohr. Get that guy and we'll talk with him first.
I was always dumb in that way. I never knew who I was talking to. I was always worried about the physics. If the idea looked lousy, I said it looked lousy. If it looked good, I said it looked good. Simple proposition. I've always lived that way. It's nice. It's pleasant, if you can do it. I'm lucky in my life that I can do this. After we'd made the calculations, the next thing that happened, of course, was the test. I was actually at home on a short vacation at that time after my wife died, and so I got a message that said, The baby is expected on such and such a day. I flew back, and I arrived just when the buses were leaving. So I went straight out to the site and we waited out there, 20 miles away. We had a radio, and they were supposed to tell us when the thing was going to go off and so forth. But the radio wouldn't work, so we never knew what was happening. But just a few minutes before it was supposed to go off, the radio started to work, and they told us there was 20 seconds or something to go, for people who were very far away like we were. Others were closer, 6 miles away. They gave out dark glasses that you could watch it with. Dark glasses! 20 miles away, you couldn't see a damn thing through dark glasses. So I figured the only thing that could really hurt your eyes, bright light can never hurt your eyes, is ultraviolet light. I got behind a truck windshield because the ultraviolet light can't go through glass. So that would be safe, and so I could see the damn thing. Time comes, and this tremendous flash out there is so bright that I duck, and I see this purple splotch on the floor of the truck. I said, That's not it. That's an after image. So I look back up, and I see this white light changing into yellow and then into orange. Clouds form and disappear again from the compression and expansion of the shock wave. Finally, a big ball of orange, the center that was so bright, becomes a ball of orange that starts to rise and billow a little bit and get a little black around the edges, and then you see it's a big ball of smoke with flashes on the inside of the fire going out. All this took about 1 minute. It was a series from bright to dark, and I had seen it. I am about the only guy who actually looked at the damn thing. The first Trinity test. Everybody else had dark glasses, and the people at 6 miles couldn't see it because they were all told to lie on the floor. I'm probably the only guy who saw it with the human eye. Finally, after about a minute and a half, there's suddenly a tremendous noise. Bang! And then a rumble like thunder. And that's what convinced me. Nobody had said a word during this whole thing. We were all just watching quietly. But this sound released everybody, released me particularly, because the solidity of the sound at that distance meant that it had really worked. The man standing next to me said, What's that? I said, That was the bomb. The man was William Lawrence. He was there to write an article describing the whole situation. I had been the one who was supposed to have taken him around. Then it was found that it was too technical for him, and so later H.D. Smythe came, and I showed him around. One thing we did, we went into a room, and there on the end of a narrow pedestal was a small silver-plated ball. You could put your hand on it. It was warm. It was radioactive. It was plutonium. And we stood at the door of this room, talking about it. This was a new element that was made by man, that had never existed on the Earth before, except for a very short period, possibly at the very beginning. And here it was, all isolated and radioactive, and had these properties. And we had made it. And so it was tremendously valuable. Meanwhile, you know how people do when they talk. You kind of jiggle around and so forth. He was kicking the doorstop, you see, and I said, "Yes, the doorstop certainly is appropriate for this door." The doorstop was a 10-inch hemisphere of yellowish metal. Gold, as a matter of fact. What had happened was that we needed to do an experiment to see how many neutrons were reflected by different materials in order to save the neutrons so we didn't use so much material. We had tested many different materials. We had tested platinum. We had tested zinc. We had tested brass. We had tested gold. So in making the tests with the gold, we had these pieces of gold, and somebody had the clever idea of using that great ball of gold for a doorstop for the door of the room that contained the plutonium. After the thing went off, there was tremendous excitement at Los Alamos. Everybody had parties. We all ran around. I sat on the end of a jeep and beat drums and so on. But one man, I remember, Bob Wilson, was just sitting there moping. I said, "What are you moping about?" He said, "It's a terrible thing that we made." I said, "But you started it. You got us into it. You see, what happened to me, what happened to the rest of us, is we started for a good reason. Then you're working very hard to accomplish something, and it's a pleasure, it's excitement, and you stop thinking, you know. You just stop." Bob Wilson was the only one who was still thinking about it at that moment. I returned to civilization shortly after that and went to Cornell to teach, and my first impression was a very strange one. I can't understand it anymore, but I felt very strongly then. I sat in a restaurant in New York, for example, and I looked out at the buildings and I began to think, you know, about how much the radius of the Hiroshima bomb damage was and so forth. How far from here was 34th Street? All those buildings, all smashed, and so on. And I would go along, and I would see people building a bridge, or they'd be making a new road, and I thought, they're crazy. They just don't understand. They don't understand. Why are they making new things? It's so useless. But fortunately, it's been useless for almost 40 years now, hasn't it? So I've been wrong about it being useless making bridges, and I'm glad those other people had the sense to go ahead. Safecracker meets Safecracker. I learned to pick locks from a guy named Leo Lavatelli. It turns out that picking ordinary tumbler locks, like Yale locks, is easy. You try to turn the lock by putting a screwdriver in the hole. You have to push from the side in order to leave the hole open. It doesn't turn because there are some pins inside which have to be lifted to just the right height by the key. Because it is not made perfectly, the lock is held more by one pin than the others. Now, if you push a little wire gadget, maybe a paper clip with a slight bump at the end, and jiggle it back and forth inside the lock, you'll eventually push that one pin that's doing the most holding up to the right height. The lock gives, just a little bit, so the first pin stays up. It's caught on the edge. Now most of the load is held by another pin, and you repeat the same random process for a few more minutes, until all the pins are pushed up. What often happens is that the screwdriver will slip and you hear tick, 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 and it makes you mad. There are little springs that push the pins back down when a key is removed, and you can hear them click when you let go of the screwdriver. Sometimes you intentionally let go of the screwdriver to see if you're getting anywhere. You might be pushing the wrong way, for instance. The process is something like Sisyphus. You're always falling back downhill. It's a simple process, but practice helps a lot. You learn how hard to push on things, hard enough so the pins will stay up, but not so hard that they won't go up in the first place. What is not really appreciated by most people is that they're perpetually locking themselves in with locks everywhere, and it's not very hard to pick them. When we started to work on the atomic bomb project at Los Alamos, everything was in such a hurry that it wasn't really ready. All the secrets of the project, everything about the atomic bomb, were kept in filing cabinets which, if they had locks at all, were locked with padlocks which had maybe only 3 pins. They were as easy as pie to open. To improve security, the shop outfitted every filing cabinet with a long rod that went down through the handles of the drawers and that was fastened by a padlock. Some guy said to me, "Look at this new thing the shop put on. Can you open the cabinet now?" I looked at the back of the cabinet and saw that the drawers didn't have a solid bottom. There was a slot with a wire rod in each one that held a slidable piece, which holds the papers up inside the drawer. I poked in from the back, slid the piece back, and began pulling the papers out through the slot. "Look," I said, "I don't even have to pick the lock." Los Alamos was a very cooperative place, and we felt it our responsibility to point out things that should be improved. I'd keep complaining that the stuff was unsafe, and although everybody thought it was safe, because there were steel rods and padlocks, it didn't mean a damn thing. To demonstrate that the locks meant nothing, whenever I wanted somebody's report and they weren't around, I'd just go in their office, open the filing cabinet, and take it out. When I was finished, I would give it back to the guy. "Thanks for your report." "Where did you get it?" "Out of your filing cabinet." "But I locked it." "I know you locked it. The locks are no good." Finally, some filing cabinets came which had combination locks on them made by the Mosler Safe Company. They had 3 drawers. Pulling the top drawer out would release the other drawers by a catch. The top drawer was opened by turning a combination wheel to the left, right, and left for the combination, and then right to number 10, which would draw back a bolt inside. The whole filing cabinet could be locked by closing the bottom drawers first, then the top drawer, and spinning the combination wheel away from number 10, which pushed up the bolt. These new filing cabinets were an immediate challenge, naturally. I love puzzles. One guy tries to make something to keep another guy out. There must be a way to beat it. I had first to understand how the lock worked, so I took apart the one in my office. The way it worked is this. There are 3 discs on a single shaft, one behind the other. Each has a notch in a different place. The idea is to line up the notches so that when you turn the wheel to 10, the little friction drive will draw the bolt down into the slot generated by the notches of the 3 discs. Now to turn the discs, there's a pin sticking out from the back of the combination wheel, and a pin sticking up from the first disc at the same radius. Within 1 turn of the combination wheel, you've picked up the 1st disc. On the back of the 1st disc, there's a pin at the same radius as a pin on the front of the 2nd disc. So by the time you've spun the combination wheel around 2x, you've picked up the 2nd disc as well. Keep turning the wheel, and a pin on the back of the 2nd disc will catch a pin on the front of the 3rd disc. Which you now set into the proper position with the 1st number of the combination. Now you have to turn the combination wheel the other way 1 full turn to catch the 2nd disc from the other side, and then continue to the 2nd number of the combination to set the 2nd disc. Again, you reverse direction and set the 1st disc to its proper place. Now the notches are lined up, and by turning the wheel to 10, you open the cabinet. Well, I struggled. And I couldn't get anywhere. I bought a couple of safecracker books, but they were all the same. In the beginning of the book, there are some stories of the fantastic achievements of the safecracker, such as the woman caught in a meat refrigerator who is freezing to death, but the safecracker, hanging upside down, opens it in 2 minutes. Or there are some precious furs or gold bullion underwater down in the sea, and the safecracker dives down and opens the chest. In the 2nd part of the book, they tell you how to crack a safe. There are all kinds of ninny-pinny dopey things like, it might be a good idea to try a date for the combination, because lots of people like to use dates. Or, think of the psychology of the owner of the safe and what he might use for the combination. And, the secretary is often worried that she might forget the combination of the safe, so she might write it down in one of the following places, along the edge of her desk drawer, on a list of names and addresses. And so on. They did tell me something sensible about how to open ordinary safes, and it's easy to understand. Ordinary safes have an extra handle, so if you push down on the handle while you're turning the combination wheel, things being unequal, as with locks, the force of the handle, trying to push the bolt down into the notches, which are not lined up, is held up more by one disc than another. When the notch on that disc comes under the bolt, there's a tiny click that you can hear with a stethoscope, or a slight decrease in friction that you can feel. You don't have to sandpaper your fingertips. And you know, there's a number. You don't know whether it's the first, second, or third number, but you can get a pretty good idea of that by finding out how many times you have to turn the wheel the other way to hear the same click again. If it's a little less than once, it's the first disc. If it's a little less than twice, it's the second disc. You have to make a correction for the thickness of the pins. This useful trick only works on ordinary safes, which have the extra handle, so I was stymied. I tried all kinds of subsidiary tricks with the cabinets, such as finding out how to release the latches on the lower drawers without opening the top drawer, by taking off a screw in front and poking around with a piece of hanger wire. I tried spinning the combination wheel very rapidly and then going to 10, thus putting a little friction on, which I hoped would stop a disc at the right point in some manner. I tried all kinds of things. I was desperate. I also did a certain amount of systematic study. For instance, a typical combination was 69, 32, 21. How far off could a number be when you're opening the safe? If the number was 69, would 68 work? Would 67 work? On the particular locks we had, the answer was yes for both, but 66 wouldn't work. You could be off by two in either direction. That meant you only had to try one out of five numbers, so you could try 0, 5, 10, 15, and so on. With 20 such numbers on a wheel of 100, that was 8,000 possibilities instead of the 1 million you would get if you had to try every single number. Now the question was, how long would it take me to try the 8,000 combinations? Suppose I've got the first two numbers right of a combination I'm trying to get. Say the numbers are 69, 32, but I don't know it. I've got them as 70, 30. Now I can try the 20 possible third numbers without having to set up the first two numbers each time. Now let's suppose I have only the first number of the combination right. After trying the 20 numbers on the third disc, I move the second wheel only a little bit, and then do another 20 numbers on the third wheel. I practiced all the time on my own safe, so I could do this process as fast as I could and not get lost in my mind as to which number I was pushing, and mess up the first number. Like a guy who practices sleight of hand, I got it down to an absolute rhythm, so I could try the 400 possible back numbers in less than half an hour. That meant I could open a safe in a maximum of 8 hours, with an average time of 4 hours. There was another guy there at Los Alamos named Staley, who was also interested in locks. We talked about it from time to time, but we weren't getting anywhere much. After I got this idea how to open a safe in an average time of 4 hours, I wanted to show Staley how to do it. So I went into a guy's office over in the computing department and asked, "Do you mind if I use your safe? I'd like to show Staley something." Meanwhile, some guys in the computing department came around and one of them said, "Hey, everybody, Fineman's going to show Staley how to open a safe." Ha ha ha. I wasn't going to actually open the safe. I was just going to show Staley this way of quickly trying the back two numbers without losing your place and having to set up the first number again. I began. "Let's suppose that the first number is 40, and we're trying 15 for the second number. We go back and forth 10, back five more, and forth 10, and so on. Now we've tried all the possible third numbers. Now we try 20 for the second number. We go back and forth 10, back five more, and forth 10, back five more, and forth..." Click! My jaw dropped. The first and second numbers happened to be right. Nobody saw my expression, because my back was towards them. Staley looked very surprised, but both of us caught on very quickly as to what happened. So I pulled the top drawer out with a flourish and said, "And there you are." Staley said, "Well, I see what you mean. It's a very good scheme." And we walked out. Everybody was amazed. It was complete luck. Now I really had a reputation for opening safes. It took me about a year and a half to get that far. Of course, I was working on the bomb, too. but I figured that I had the safes beaten, in the sense that if there was a real difficulty, if somebody was lost or dead, and nobody else knew the combination but the stuff in the filing cabinet was needed, I could open it. After reading what preposterous things the safecrackers claimed, I thought that was a rather respectable accomplishment. We had no entertainment there at Los Alamos, and we had to amuse ourselves somehow, so fiddling with the Mosler lock on my filing cabinet was one of my entertainments. One day I made an interesting observation. When the lock is opened, and the drawer has been pulled out and the wheel is left on 10, which is what people do when they've opened their filing cabinet and are taking papers out of it, the bolt is still down. Now what does that mean, the bolt is still down? It means the bolt is in the slot made by the three discs, which are still properly lined up. Ah. Now if I turn the wheel away from 10 a little bit, the bolt comes up. If I immediately go back to 10, the bolt goes back down again, because I haven't yet disturbed the slot. If I keep going away from 10 in steps of 5, at some point, the bolt won't go back down when I go back to 10. The slot has just been disturbed. The number just before, which still let the bolt go down, is the last number of the combination. I realized that I could do the same thing to find the second number. As soon as I know the last number, I can turn the wheel around the other way and again, in lumps of 5, push the second disc bit by bit until the bolt doesn't go down. The number just before would be the second number. If I were very patient, I would be able to pick up all three numbers that way. But the amount of work involved in picking up the first number of the combination by this elaborate scheme would be much more than just trying the 20 possible first numbers with the other two numbers that you already know when the filing cabinet is closed. I practiced and I practiced until I could get the last two numbers off an open filing cabinet, hardly looking at the dial. Then, when I'd be in some guy's office discussing some physics problem, I'd lean against his open filing cabinet, and just like a guy who's jiggling keys absent-mindedly while he's talking, I'd just wobble the dial back and forth, back and forth. Sometimes I'd put my finger on the bolt, so I wouldn't have to look to see if it's coming up. In this way, I picked off the last two numbers of various filing cabinets. When I got back to my office, I would write the two numbers down on a piece of paper that I kept inside the lock of my filing cabinet. I took the lock apart each time to get the paper. I thought that was a very safe place for them. After a while, my reputation began to sail because things like this would happen. Somebody would say, "Hey, Feynman, Christie's out of town and we need a document from his safe. Can you open it?" If it was a safe I knew I didn't have the last two numbers of, I would simply say, "I'm sorry, but I can't do it now. I've got this work that I have to do." Otherwise, I would say, "Yeah, but I gotta get my tools." I didn't need any tools, but I'd go back to my office, open my filing cabinet, and look at my little piece of paper. Christie, 3560. Then I'd get a screwdriver and go over to Christie's office and close the door behind me. Obviously, not everybody is supposed to be allowed to know how to do this. I'd be in there alone, and I'd open the safe in a few minutes. All I had to do was try the first number at most 20 times, then sit around, reading a magazine or something, for 15 or 20 minutes. There was no use trying to make it look too easy. Somebody would figure out there was a trick to it. After a while, I'd open the door and say, "It's open." People thought I was opening the safes from scratch. Now I could maintain the idea, which began with that accident with Staley, that I could open safes cold. Nobody figured out that I was picking the last two numbers off their safes, even though, perhaps because, I was doing it all the time, like a card sharp walking around all the time with a deck of cards. I often went to Oak Ridge to check up on the safety of the uranium plant. Everything was always in a hurry because it was wartime, and one time I had to go there on a weekend. It was Sunday, and we were in this fella's office, a general, the head or a vice president of some company, a couple of other big muckamucks, and me. We were gathered together to discuss a report that was in the fella's safe, a secret safe, when suddenly he realized that he didn't know the combination. His secretary was the only one who knew it, so we called her home, and it turned out she had gone on a picnic up in the hills. While all this was going on, I asked, "Do you mind if I fiddle with the safe?" "Ha ha ha, not at all." So I went over to the safe and started to fool around. They began to discuss how they could get a car to try to find the secretary, and the guy was getting more and more embarrassed because he had all these people waiting and he was such a jackass he didn't even know how to open his own safe. Everybody was all tense and getting mad at him, when, click, the safe opened. In 10 minutes I had opened the safe that contained all the secret documents about the plant. They were astonished. The safes were apparently not very safe. It was a terrible shock. All this eyes-only stuff, top secret, locked in this wonderful secret safe, and this guy opens it in 10 minutes. Of course I was able to open the safe because of my perpetual habit of taking the last two numbers off. While in Oak Ridge, the month before, I was in the same office when the safe was open and I took the numbers off in an absent-minded way. I was always practicing my obsession. Although I hadn't written them down, I was able to vaguely remember what they were. First I tried 40-15, then 15-40, but neither of those worked. Then I tried 10-45 with all the first numbers, and it opened. A similar thing happened on another weekend when I was visiting Oak Ridge. I had written a report that had to be okayed by a colonel, and it was in his safe. Everybody else keeps documents in filing cabinets like the ones at Los Alamos, but he was a colonel, so he had a much fancier two-door safe with big handles that pull 4 3/4-inch thick steel bolts back from the frame. The great brass doors swung open, and he took out my report to read. Not having had an opportunity to see any really good safes, I said to him, "Would you mind while you're reading my report if I looked at your safe?" "Go right ahead," he said, convinced that there was nothing I could do. I looked at the back of one of the solid brass doors, and I discovered that the combination wheel was connected to a little lock that looked exactly the same as the little unit that was in my filing cabinet at Los Alamos. Same company, same little bolt, except that when the bolt came down, the big handles on the safe could then move some rods sideways, and with a bunch of levers you could pull back all those 3/4-inch steel rods. The whole lever system, it appeared, depends on the same little bolt that locks filing cabinets. Just for the sake of professional perfection, to make sure it was the same, I took the two numbers off the same way I did with the filing cabinet safes. Meanwhile, he was reading the report. When he'd finished, he said, "All right, it's fine." He put the report in the safe, grabbed the big handles, and swung the great brass doors together. It sounds so good when they close, but I know it's all psychological, because it's nothing but the same damn lock. I couldn't help but needle him a little bit. I always had a thing about military guys in such wonderful uniforms. So I said, "The way you close that safe, I get the idea that you think things are safe in there."
"Of course."
"The only reason you think they're safe in there is because civilians call it a safe." I put the word civilians in there to make it sound as if he'd been had by civilians. He got very angry.
"What do you mean, it's not safe? Good safe cracker could open it in 30 minutes. "Can you open it in 30 minutes?
I said, "A good safe cracker. It would take me about 45.
"Well," he said, "my wife is waiting at home for me with supper, but I'm going to stay here and watch you, and you're going to sit down there and work on that damn thing for 45 minutes and not open it."
He sat down in his big leather chair, put his feet up on his desk, and read. With complete confidence, I picked up a chair, carried it over to the safe, and sat down in front of it. I began to turn the wheel at random, just to make some action. After about 5 minutes, which is quite a long time when you're just sitting and waiting, he lost some patience.
"Well, are you making any progress?"
With a thing like this, you either open it or you don't. I figured 1 or 2 more minutes would be about time, so I began to work in earnest, and 2 minutes later, clink, it opened. The colonel's jaw dropped, and his eyes bugged out. "Colonel," I said, in a serious tone, "let me tell you something about these locks. When the door to the safe, or the top drawer of the filing cabinet is left open, it's very easy for someone to get the combination. That's what I did while you were reading my report, just to demonstrate the danger. You should insist that everybody keep their filing cabinet drawers locked while they're working, because when they're open, they're very, very vulnerable."
"Yeah, I see what you mean. That's very interesting."
We were on the same side after that. The next time I went to Oak Ridge, all the secretaries and people who knew who I was were telling me, "Don't come through here! Don't come through here!" The colonel had sent a note around to everyone in the plant which said, "During his last visit, Was Mr. Feynman at any time in your office, near your office, or walking through your office? Some people answered yes. Others said no. The ones who had said yes got another note. Please change the combination of your safe. That was his solution. I was the danger. So they all had to change their combinations on account of me. It's a pain in the neck to change a combination and remember the new one. So they were all mad at me and didn't want me to come near them. They might have to change their combinations once again. Of course, their filing cabinets were still left open while they were working. A library at Los Alamos held all of the documents we had ever worked on. It was a solid, concrete room with a big, beautiful door which had a metal wheel that turns, like a safe deposit vault. During the war, I had tried to look at it closely. I knew the girl who was the librarian, and I begged her to let me play with it a little bit. I was fascinated by it. It was the biggest lock I ever saw. I discovered that I could never use my method of picking off the last two numbers to get in. In fact, while turning the knob while the door was open, I made the lock close, so it was sticking out, and they couldn't close the door again until the girl came and opened the lock again. That was the end of my fiddling around with that lock. I didn't have time to figure out how it worked. It was much beyond my capacity. During the summer after the war, I had some documents to write and work to finish up. So I went back to Los Alamos from Cornell, where I had taught during the year. In the middle of my work, I had to refer to a document that I had written before but couldn't remember, and it was down in the library. I went down to get the document, and there was a soldier walking back and forth with a gun. It was Saturday, and after the war, the library was closed on Saturdays. Then I remembered what a good friend of mine, Frederick de Hoffman, had done. He was in the declassification section. After the war, the Army was thinking of declassifying some documents, and he had to go back and forth to the library so much, look at this document, look at that document, check this, check that, that he was going nuts. So he had a copy of every document, all the secrets to the atomic bomb, in 9 filing cabinets in his office. I went down to his office, and the lights were on. It looked as if whoever was there, perhaps his secretary, had just stepped out for a few minutes, so I waited. While I was waiting, I started to fiddle around with the combination wheel on one of the filing cabinets. By the way, I didn't have the last two numbers for de Hoffman's safes. They were put in after the war, after I had left. I started to play with one of the combination wheels and began to think about the safecracker books. I thought to myself, I've never been much impressed by the tricks described in those books, so I've never tried them. But let's see if we can open de Hoffman's safe by following the book. First trick, the secretary. She's afraid she's going to forget the combination, so she writes it down somewhere. I started to look in some of the places mentioned in the book. The desk drawer was locked, but it was an ordinary lock like Leo Lavatelli taught me how to open. Ping! I look along the edge. Nothing. Then I look through the secretary's papers. I found a sheet of paper that all the secretaries had, with the Greek letters carefully made, so they could recognize them in mathematical formulas. And named. And there, carelessly written along the top of the paper, was pi equals 3.14159. Now that's 6 digits. And why does the secretary have to know the numerical value of pi? It was obvious. There was no other reason. I went over to the filing cabinet and tried the first one. 31, 41, 59. It didn't open. Then I tried 59, 41, 31. That didn't work either. Then, 95, 14, 13. Backwards, forwards, upside down, turn it this way, turn it that. Nothing. I closed the desk drawer and started to walk out the door, when I thought of the safecracker books again. Next, try the psychology method. I said to myself, Freddy de Hoffman is just the kind of guy to use a mathematical constant for a safe combination. I went back to the first filing cabinet and tried 27, 18, 28. Click. It opened. The mathematical constant second in importance to pi is the base of natural logarithms. E is 2.71828. There were 9 filing cabinets, and I had opened the first one, but the document I wanted was in another one. They were in alphabetical order by author. I tried the second filing cabinet. 27, 18, 28. Click. It opened with the same combination. I thought, this is wonderful. I've opened the secrets to the atomic bomb, but if I'm ever going to tell this story, I've got to make sure that all the combinations are really the same. Some of the filing cabinets were in the next room, so I tried 27, 18, 28 on one of them, and it opened. Now I'd opened three safes, all the same. I thought to myself, now I could write a safecracker book that would beat every one, because at the beginning I would tell how I opened safes whose contents were bigger and more valuable than what any safecracker anywhere had opened, except for a life, of course. But compared to the furs or the gold bullion, I have them all beat. I opened the safes which contained all the secrets to the atomic bomb, the schedules for the production of the plutonium, the purification procedures, how much material is needed, how the bomb works, how the neutrons are generated, what the design is, the dimensions, the entire information that was known at Los Alamos. The whole schmear. I went back to the second filing cabinet and took out the document I wanted. Then I took a red grease pencil and a piece of yellow paper that was lying around in the office and wrote, I borrowed document number LA4312. Feynman, the safecracker. I put the note on top of the papers in the filing cabinet and closed it. Then I went to the first one I had opened and wrote another note. This one was no harder to open than the other one. Wise guy. And shut the cabinet. Then in the other cabinet, in the other room, I wrote, when the combinations are all the same, one is no harder to open than another. Same guy. And I shut that one. I went back to my office and wrote my report. That evening I went to the cafeteria and ate supper. There was Freddy de Hoffman. He said he was going over to his office to work, so just for fun, I went with him. He started to work, and soon he went into the other room to open one of the filing cabinets in there, something I hadn't counted on, and he happened to open the filing cabinet I had put the third note in first. He opened the drawer, and he saw this foreign object in there, this bright yellow paper with something scrawled on it in bright red crayon. I had read in books that when somebody is afraid, his face gets sallow, but I had never seen it before. Well, it's absolutely true. His face turned a gray-yellow-green. It was really frightening to see. He picked up the paper, and his hand was shaking.
Look at this, he said, trembling.
The note said, when the combinations are all the same, one is no harder to open than another. Same guy. What does it mean? I said.
All the combinations of my safes are the same, he stammered.
That ain't such a good idea.
I know that now, he said, completely shaken.
Another effect of the blood draining from the face must be that the brain doesn't work right.
He signed who it was. He signed who it was, he said.
What? I hadn't put my name on that one.
Yes, he said. It's the same guy who's been trying to get into Building Omega.
All during the war and even after, there were these perpetual rumors. Somebody's been trying to get into Building Omega. You see, during the war, they were doing experiments for the bomb in which they wanted to get enough material together for the chain reaction to just get started. They would drop one piece of material through another, and when it went through, the reaction would start, and they'd measure how many neutrons they got. The piece would fall through so fast that nothing should build up and explode. Enough of a reaction would begin, however, so they could tell that things were really starting correctly, that the rates were right, and everything was going according to prediction. A very dangerous experiment. Naturally, they were not doing this experiment in the middle of Los Alamos, but off several miles in a canyon several mesas over, all isolated. This Building Omega had its own fence around it with guard towers. In the middle of the night, when everything's quiet, some rabbit comes out of the brush and smashes against the fence and makes a noise. The guard shoots. The lieutenant in charge comes around. What's the guard going to say? That it was only a rabbit? No.
Somebody's been trying to get into Building Omega, and I scared him off.
So de Hoffman was pale and shaking, and he didn't realize there was a flaw in his logic. It was not clear that the same guy who'd been trying to get into Building Omega was the same guy who was standing next to him. He asked me what to do. Well, see if any documents are missing. It looks all right, he said. I don't see any missing. I tried to steer him to the filing cabinet I took my document out of. Well, if all the combinations are the same, perhaps he's taken something from another drawer. Right, he said, and he went back into his office and opened the first filing cabinet and found the second note I wrote. This one was no harder to open than the other one. Wise guy. By that time, it didn't make any difference whether it was same guy or wise guy. It was completely clear to him that it was the guy who was trying to get into Building Omega. So to convince him to open the filing cabinet with my first note in it was particularly difficult, and I don't remember how I talked him into it. He started to open it, so I began to walk down the hall, because I was a little bit afraid that when he found out who did it to him, I was going to get my throat cut. Sure enough, he came running down the hall after me, but instead of being angry, he practically put his arms around me because he was so completely relieved that this terrible burden of the atomic secrets being stolen was only me doing mischief. A few days later, de Hoffman told me that he needed something from Kirst's safe. Donald Kirst had gone back to Illinois and was hard to reach. If you can open all my safes using the psychological method, de Hoffman said, I had told him how I did it, maybe you could open Kirst's safe that way. By now the story had gotten around, so several people came to watch this fantastic process where I was going to open Kirst's safe cold. There was no need for me to be alone. I didn't have the last two numbers to Kirst's safe, and to use the psychology method, I needed people around who knew Kirst. We all went over to Kirst's office, and I checked the drawers for clues. There was nothing. Then I asked them, what kind of a combination would Kirst use? A mathematical constant? Oh, no, de Hoffman said. Kirst would do something very simple. I tried 10, 20, 30, 20, 40, 60, 60, 40, 20, 30, 20, 10. Nothing. Then I said, do you think he would use a date? Yeah, they said. He's just the kind of guy to use a date. We tried various dates. 8, 6, 45, when the bomb went off. 86, 19, 45. This date, that date, when the project started. Nothing worked. By this time, most of the people had drifted off. They didn't have the patience to watch me do this, but the only way to solve such a thing is patience. Then I decided to try everything from about 1900 until now. That sounds like a lot, but it's not. The first number is a month, 1 through 12, and I can try that using only three numbers, 10, 5, and 0. The second number is a day, from 1 to 31, which I can try with six numbers. The third number is the year, which was only 47 numbers at that time, which I could try with nine numbers. So the 8,000 combinations have been reduced to 162, something I could try in 15 or 20 minutes. Unfortunately, I started with the high end of the numbers for the months, because when I finally opened it, the combination was 0, 5, 35. I turned to de Hoffman. What happened to Kirst around January 5th, 1935? His daughter was born in 1936, de Hoffman said. It must be her birthday. Now I had opened two safes cold. I was getting good. Now I was professional. That same summer after the war, the guy from the property section was trying to take back some of the things the government had bought to sell again as surplus. One of the things was a captain's safe. We all knew about this safe. The captain, when he arrived during the war, decided that the filing cabinets weren't safe enough for the secrets he was going to get, so he had to have a special safe. The captain's office was on the second floor of one of the flimsy wooden buildings that we all had our offices in, and the safe he ordered was a heavy steel safe. The workmen had to put down platforms of wood and use special jacks to get it up the steps. Since there wasn't much amusement, we all watched this big safe being moved up to his office with great effort, and we all made jokes about what kind of secrets he was going to keep in there. Some fella said we ought to put our stuff in his safe and let him put his stuff in ours. So everyone knew about this safe. The property section man wanted it for surplus, but first it had to be emptied, and the only people who knew the combination were the captain, who was in bikini, and Alvarez, who'd forgotten it. The man asked me to open it. I went up to his old office and said to the secretary, why don't you phone the captain and ask him the combination? I don't want to bother him, she said. Well, you're going to bother me for maybe 8 hours. I won't do it unless you make an attempt to call him. Okay, she said. She picked up the telephone, and I went into the other room to look at the safe. There it was, that huge steel safe, and its doors were wide open. I went back to the secretary. "It's open." "Marvelous," she said, as she put down the phone. "No," I said, "it was already open." "Oh, I guess the property section was able to open it after all." I went down to the man in the property section. I went up to the safe, and it was already open. "Oh, yeah," he said. "I'm sorry I didn't tell you. I sent our regular locksmith up there to drill it, but before he drilled it, he tried to open it, and he opened it." So, first information, Los Alamos now has a regular locksmith. Second information, this man knows how to drill safes, something I know nothing about. Third information, he can open a safe cold in a few minutes. This is a real professional, a real source of information. This guy I have to meet. I found out he was a locksmith they had hired after the war, when they weren't as concerned about security, to take care of such things. It turned out that he didn't have enough work to do opening safes, so he also repaired the Marchant calculators we had used. During the war, I repaired those things all the time, so I had a way to meet him. Now, I have never been surreptitious or tricky about meeting somebody. I just go right up and introduce myself. But in this case, it was so important to meet this man, and I knew that before he would tell me any of his secrets on how to open safes, I would have to prove myself. I found out where his room was, in the basement of the theoretical physics section where I worked, and I knew he worked in the evening, when the machines weren't being used. So at first I would walk past his door on my way to my office in the evening. That's all. I just walk past. A few nights later, just a hi. After a while, when he saw it was the same guy walking past, he'd say, "Hi," or "Good evening." A few weeks of this slow process, and I see he's working on the Marchant calculators. I see nothing about them. It isn't time yet. I gradually say a little more. "Hi. I see you're working pretty hard." "Yeah, pretty hard." That kind of stuff. Finally, a breakthrough. He invites me for soup. It's going very good now. Every evening we have soup together. Now I begin to talk a little bit about the adding machines, and he tells me he has a problem. He's been trying to put a succession of spring-loaded wheels back onto a shaft, and he doesn't have the right tool or something. He's been working on it for a week. I tell him that I used to work on those machines during the war, and I'll tell you what. You just leave the machine out tonight, and I'll have a look at it tomorrow. "Okay," he says, because he's desperate. The next day I looked at the damn thing and tried to load it by holding all the wheels in my hand. It kept snapping back. I thought to myself, if he's been trying the same thing for a week, and I'm trying it and can't do it, it ain't the way to do it. I stopped and looked at it very carefully, and I noticed that each wheel had a little hole, just a little hole. Then it dawned on me. I sprung the first one. Then I put a piece of wire through the little hole. Then I sprung the second one and put the wire through it. Then the next one. The next one, like putting beads on a string, and I strung the whole thing the first time I tried it, got it all in line, pulled the wire out, and everything was okay. That night I showed him the little hole and how I did it, and from then on we talked a lot about machines. We got to be good friends. Now in his office there were a lot of little cubby holes that contained locks half taken apart, and pieces from safes, too. Oh, they were beautiful. But I still didn't say a word about locks and safes. Finally, I figured the day was coming, so I decided to put out a little bit of bait about safes. I'd tell him the only thing worth a damn that I knew about them, that you can take the last two numbers off while it's open. "Hey," I said, looking over at the cubbyholes, "I see you're working on Mosler safes."
"Yeah."
"You know these locks are weak. If they're open, you can take the last two numbers off." "You can?" he said, finally showing some interest. "Yeah." "Show me how," he said. I showed him how to do it, and he turned to me. "What's your name?" All this time, we had never exchanged names. "Dick Feynman," I said.
"God, you're Feynman," he said in awe. "The great safecracker. I've heard about you. I wanted to meet you for so long. I wanted to learn how to crack a safe from you."
"What do you mean? You know how to open safes cold."
"I don't."
"Listen. I heard about the captain's safe, and I've been working pretty hard all this time because I wanted to meet you. And you tell me you don't know how to open a safe cold? That's right. Well, you must know how to drill a safe. I don't know how to do that either. What? I exclaimed. The guy in the property section said you picked up your tools and went up to drill the captain's safe. Suppose you had a job as a locksmith, he said, and a guy comes down and asks you to drill a safe. What would you do? Well, I replied, I'd make a fancy thing of putting my tools together, pick them up and take them to the safe. Then I'd put my drill up against the safe somewhere at random and I'd go, vroom, so I'd save my job. That's exactly what I was going to do. But you opened it. You must know how to crack safes. Oh, yeah. I knew that the locks come from the factory set at 25025 or 502550, so I thought, who knows, maybe the guy didn't bother to change the combination. And the second one worked. So I did learn something from him, that he cracked safes by the same miraculous methods that I did. But even funnier was that this big-shot captain had to have a super, super safe and had people go to all that trouble to hoist the thing up into his office, and he didn't even bother to set the combination. I went from office to office in my building, trying those two factory combinations, and I opened about one safe in five. Uncle Sam doesn't need you. After the war, the army was scraping the bottom of the barrel to get the guys for the occupation forces in Germany. Up until then, the army deferred people for some reason other than physical first. I was deferred because I was working on the bomb. But now they reversed that and gave everybody a physical first. That summer, I was working for Hans Bethe at General Electric in Schenectady, New York, and I remember that I had to go some distance. I think it was to Albany to take the physical. I get to the draft place, and I'm handed a lot of forms to fill out, and then I start going around to all these different booths. They check your vision at one, your hearing at another, they take your blood sample at another, and so forth. Anyway, finally you come to booth number 13, psychiatrist. There you wait, sitting on one of the benches, and while I'm waiting I can see what is happening. There are three desks, with a psychiatrist behind each one. And the culprit sits across from the psychiatrist in his BVDs and answers various questions. At that time, there were a lot of movies about psychiatrists. For example, there was Spellbound, in which a woman who used to be a great piano player has her hands stuck in some awkward position and she can't move them, and her family calls in a psychiatrist to help her, and the psychiatrist goes upstairs into a room with her, and you see the door close behind them, and downstairs the family is discussing what's going to happen. And then she comes out of the room, hands still stuck in the horrible position, walks dramatically down the stairs over to the piano and sits down, lifts her hands over the keyboard, and suddenly, dum-diddle-dum-diddle-dum-dum-dum, she can play again. Well, I can't stand this kind of baloney, and I had decided that psychiatrists are fakers, and I'll have nothing to do with them. So that was the mood I was in when it was my turn to talk to the psychiatrist. I sit down at the desk, and the psychiatrist starts looking through my papers. "Hello, Dick," he says in a cheerful voice. "Where do you work?" I'm thinking, what does he think he is, calling me by my first name? And I say coldly, "Schenectady." "Who do you work for, Dick?" says the psychiatrist, smiling again. "General Electric." "Do you like your work, Dick?" he says with that same big smile on his face. So-so. I just wasn't going to have anything to do with him. Three nice questions, and then the fourth one is completely different. "Do you think people talk about you?" he asks in a low, serious tone. I light up and say, "Sure. When I go home, my mother often tells me how she was telling her friends about me." He isn't listening to the explanation. Instead, he's writing something down on my paper. Then again, in a low, serious tone, he says, "Do you think people stare at you?" I'm all ready to say no when he says, "For instance, do you think any of the boys waiting on the benches are staring at you now?" While I had been waiting to talk to the psychiatrist, I had noticed there were about 12 guys on the bench waiting for the three psychiatrists, and they've got nothing else to look at, so I divide 12 by 3, that makes 4 each, but I'm conservative, so I say, yeah, maybe two of them are looking at us. He says, well, just turn around and look. And he's not even bothering to look himself. So I turn around, and sure enough, two guys are looking. So I point to them and I say, yeah, there's that guy and that guy over there looking at us. Of course, when I'm turned around and pointing like that, other guys start to look at us. So I say, now him, and those two over there, and now the whole bunch. He still doesn't look up to check. He's busy writing more things on my paper. Then he says, do you ever hear voices in your head? Very rarely. And I'm about to describe the two occasions on which it happened when he says, do you talk to yourself? Yeah, sometimes when I'm shaving or thinking, once in a while. He's writing down more stuff. I see you have a deceased wife. Do you talk to her? This question really annoyed me, but I contained myself and said, sometimes when I go up on a mountain and I'm thinking about her. More writing. Then he says, is anyone in your family in a mental institution? Yeah, I have an aunt in an insane asylum. Why do you call it an insane asylum? He says resentfully. Why don't you call it a mental institution? I thought it was the same thing. Just what do you think insanity is? He says angrily. It's a strange and peculiar disease in human beings, I say honestly. There's nothing any more strange or peculiar about it than appendicitis, he retorts. I don't think so. In appendicitis, we understand the causes better, and something about the mechanism of it. Whereas with insanity, it's much more complicated and mysterious. I won't go through the whole debate. The point is that I meant insanity is physiologically peculiar, and he thought I meant it was socially peculiar. Up until this time, although I had been unfriendly to the psychiatrist, I had nevertheless been honest in everything I said. But when he asked me to put out my hands, I couldn't resist pulling a trick a guy in the blood-sucking line had told me about. I figured nobody was ever going to get a chance to do this, and as long as I was halfway underwater, I would do it. So I put out my hands with one palm up and the other one down. The psychiatrist doesn't notice. He says, turn them over. I turn them over. The one that was up goes down, and the one that was down goes up. And he still doesn't notice, because he's always looking very closely at one hand to see if it is shaking. So the trick had no effect. Finally, at the end of all these questions, he becomes friendly again. He lights up and says, I see you have a PhD, Dick. Where did you study? MIT in Princeton. And where did you study? Yale in London. And what did you study, Dick? Physics. And what did you study? Medicine. And this is medicine? Well, yes. What do you think it is? You go and sit down over there and wait a few minutes. So I sit on the bench again, and one of the other guys waiting sidles up to me and says, gee, you were in there 25 minutes. The other guys were in there only 5 minutes. Yeah. Hey, he says, you want to know how to fool the psychiatrist? All you have to do is pick your nails like this. And why don't you pick your nails like that? Oh, he says, I want to get in the army. You want to fool the psychiatrist, I say? You just tell him that. After a while, I was called over to a different desk to see another psychiatrist. While the first psychiatrist had been rather young and innocent-looking, this one was gray-haired and distinguished-looking, obviously the superior psychiatrist. I figure all of this is now going to get straightened out, but no matter what happens, I'm not going to become friendly. The new psychiatrist looks at my papers, puts a big smile on his face, and says, hello, Dick. I see you worked at Los Alamos during the war. Yeah. There used to be a boys' school there, didn't there? That's right. Were there a lot of buildings in the school? Only a few. Three questions. Same technique, and the next question is completely different. You said you hear voices in your head. Describe that, please. It happens very rarely when I've been paying attention to a person with a foreign accent. As I'm falling asleep, I can hear his voice very clearly. The first time it happened was while I was a student at MIT. I could hear old Professor Velarde say, the electric field. And the other time was in Chicago during the war, when Professor Teller was explaining to me how the bomb worked. Since I'm interested in all kinds of phenomena, I wondered how I could hear all these voices with accents so precisely, when I couldn't imitate them that well. Doesn't everybody have something like that happen once in a while?